The death toll from Israeli aggression on Gaza has topped 27,100, which is an average of 230 Palestinians killed every day for the past 4 months. The Yemeni army says it has carried out a new operation against military targets in the Israeli port city of Eilat. And the United States military says it has conducted airstrikes on 85 targets inside Iraq and Syria. Thank you for joining us. Intense Israeli attacks on Gaza have been continuing for nearly 4 months now. In the latest spate of attacks, at least 100 people were killed across the besieged Palestinian territory. There were fresh air and artillery attacks around Khan Yunis. That's Gaza's main southern city, which has recently been the focal point of Israeli strikes. Medical facilities in Khan Yunis have been affected as well. Al-Amal and Al-Nasser hospitals have been under an Israeli siege for more than a week. Now, the United Nations is warning of a serious shortage of oxygen supplies at the two medical centers. After Khan Yunis, the city of Rafah will be the next target of the Israeli ground attacks. That's according to the regime's military. Rafah is located in southern Gaza and hosts hundreds of thousands of displaced Palestinians. UN agencies have been warning about the deteriorating situation in Rafah.
So I want to emphasize our deep concern about the escalation of hostilities in Khan Yunis, which has resulted in an increase in the number of internally displaced people seeking refuge in Rafah. In recent days, thousands of Palestinians have continued to flee to the south, which is already hosting over half the Gaza's population of some 2.3 million people. Most are living in makeshift structures, tents, or out in the open. Rafah is a pressure cooker of despair, and we fear for what comes next.
The spokesman for the UN Humanitarian Office also warned about disease outbreaks in Gaza. He added that there is simply not enough food, not enough clean drinking water, and no protection. The World Health Organization says people in Gaza are enduring unimaginable circumstances. They are exhausted, hungry, and traumatized. And UNICEF says at least 17,000 children in the Gaza Strip are unaccompanied or separated from their family. It says Palestinian children's mental health is severely impacted, and almost all of them are in need of support. Over 27,100 people have been killed in Gaza since October 7th. Some 12,500 of them are children. Our correspondent Moti Abu Musabe joined us earlier from Deir al-Balah city with more details on the Israeli attacks on Gaza. Let's take a listen.
Israeli bombardments are still continued in the surrounding areas of the society's headquarters in Khan Yunis city, which is Al Amal Hospital. In addition to that, they noticed that the rainwater actually leaked inside the buildings after the cracks resulted in from the continuous Israeli bombardments. The most important thing is that the dialysis patients in the hospital actually face the risk of death over the continuous siege imposed on the hospital, as the Israeli occupation forces till this moment actually prevent the Palestinian ambulances from evacuating the patients, and they shoot at everything moving in those areas, in the surrounding areas of Gaza Strip. And even though the continuous appeals for the humanitarian and the human rights organizations undergo, the Israeli occupation forces still insist on preventing the Palestinian ambulances and the medical staff from moving and to do their job. The current situation is still catastrophic in Khan Yunis city. Meanwhile, the Israeli occupation forces intensify their attacks in the southern part of the city, where Gizan Rashwan, which is a neighborhood in the southern part of the city, has been under heavy bombardment.
Maureen Kasuku is a writer and activist in Nairobi, Kenya. She earlier joined us to share her views on the genocide in Gaza. She also speaks about the measures being taken in Kenya in support of the Gazans.
It's been a very terrible 4 months since October 7th. We are witnessing a genocide take place right now, and atrocities against the people of Palestine by Israel Defense Forces has been very disheartening to witness. You know, just the news is coming in that hospitals are being attacked, that Palestinian people lack medical equipment. The situation is very dire, and for you know, all these Western powers to pull out resources from UNRWA right now when the people need it the most is should be considered a war crime. So this is very disheartening to see. And, you know, it's a challenge, it's a call for all of us in the Global South right now to unite and to bring our resources together and to bring our voices together to strongly condemn what is happening in occupied Palestine right now. I'd say a lot of effort is being put together by grassroots community organizers. For example, Kenyans for Palestine. Kenyans for Palestine is a collective of grassroots activists working towards Palestinian liberation efforts. So we have our local BDS movement here in Nairobi. We've been trying to conduct like protests and marches in support of occupied Palestine. Of course, we've been met by state resistance. We've been denied permits here in Nairobi. But I will say that generally, the public has been very responsive to the plight of Palestinians. We've seen so many people show up to our meetings, our Kenyans for Palestine planning meetings.
Palestinian resistance movements are continuing to push back against Israeli forces in Gaza as fighting on the ground intensifies. The military wing of Hamas says it killed at least 15 Israeli soldiers west of Gaza City. The Qassam Brigade also said its fighters targeted three Israeli Merkava tanks with Yasin 105 missiles. The group's fighters also hit an armored Israeli personnel carrier in Khan Yunis, south of the Strip. This, as a military wing of Islamic Jihad says, it targeted intruding Israeli forces who had gathered inside a building in Khan Yunis. The Al-Quds Brigade says 10 soldiers there have either been killed or injured. Israel has confirmed the deaths of over 220 of its soldiers since the start of the ground invasion of Gaza. However, Palestinian resistance groups say the actual number of fatalities amongst Israeli forces is much higher, and the regime is covering up its losses, fearing more Israeli public anger. The Yemeni army says it has carried out yet another operation against military targets in the Israeli port city of Eilat. Army spokesman Yahya Sari says Yemeni missile forces struck Eilat with a number of missiles. Or military forces. The army says the operation are in solidarity with Palestinians. Yemen has vowed to continue its military operations unless Israel stops its war on the Gaza Strip and ends the siege of the Palestinian territory. Yemeni forces have targeted over 24 Israeli-run or Israeli-bound vessels in the Red Sea over the past weeks.
Amid the Western aggression against Yemen, thousands of people gathered in the capital Sana'a and other cities to urge the Yemeni army to expand its naval operations against American, British and Israeli-linked vessels in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden. They also pledged to continue supporting Palestinians at all costs.
Our message to the forces of American Zionist aggression is that you need to stop killing women, children, and defenseless people in Gaza. God has blessed us with Islam, and we will not abandon our brothers in Palestine. The Westerners will see what we will do under the leadership of Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi, who does what he says.
Our hearts are broken over what's happening in Gaza, including crimes, starvation, and the siege
siege imposed on the people of Gaza. They want those who survived the bombing to starve to death.
Protesters also slammed the European Union's bid to send military forces to the Red Sea, aiming to protect Israeli maritime navigation. The demonstrators said this move will escalate the conflict, since the Yemeni army will have the right to add European vessels to its list of targets.
The European Union is America's plaything. They are indeed many countries, but they follow America's orders to serve American interests. We call the Prosperity Alliance the Suicide Alliance because they commit suicide when they fight us. And we will not change our position no matter how much they threaten us and no matter how large a force they mobilize to fight us.
Any European force that comes to the Red Sea will have the same fate as the American and British forces, meaning that they will become legitimate targets for the Yemeni naval operations and will be hit daily by the Yemeni missile strikes.
Earlier, the leader of the Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, stated that U.S. attempts to seek help from China mediation to stop Yemen's naval operations show the failure of the U.S. and U.K. in their aggression. He also criticized Arab countries for exporting goods to Israel, calling it an act of betrayal as Palestinians starve to death in the besieged Gaza.
Despite the U.S. and U.K. airstrikes, people here insist that Yemeni naval operations should continue as long as the genocidal war on Gaza rages on. They urge their army to target the interests of any party that supports the Israeli regime. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The U.S. says it has carried out airstrikes on 85 targets inside Iraq and Syria. That's after Washington pledged to respond to a deadly drone strike on its troops in Jordan. The U.S. Central Command claims the targets include depots of rockets, missiles, and unmanned drones. The U.S. president says the strikes will continue at times and places of Washington's choosing. However, Joe Biden says the U.S. does not see conflict in West Asia. Washington has confirmed the deaths of three of its forces in the drone strike that hit its military base last weekend. An Iraqi resistance group claimed responsibility for the attack. It marked the first time U.S. military personnel died in an attack since the start of the Israeli onslaught on Gaza on October the 7th. Belgium has summoned the Israeli ambassador after the country's development agency building was struck in the regime's attacks in northern Gaza. During the meeting with the Israeli envoy, Belgian foreign ministry officials condemned the bombing and destruction of the offices of the agency. According to reports, the strike on the agency took place on Wednesday. Images shared by the Belgian foreign minister show the building reduced to rubble. However, there were no employees there when the bombing occurred. In its reaction to the attack, Brussels also slammed as unacceptable Israel's bombardment of civilian infrastructure in Gaza. Belgium is a country that has decided to continue to provide financial assistance to the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, despite several countries suspending their aid over some Israeli allegations. Brussels said the UN agency cannot be replaced in supplying urgent humanitarian aid to Gaza. Another sign of growing discontent in the West over support for Israel, more than 800 officials in the US, the UK and the EU have released a public letter of dissent criticizing their government's support for the regime in its ongoing genocide in Gaza. The signatories say Israel has shown no boundaries in its military offensive in Gaza, which has resulted in tens of thousands of preventable civilian deaths and the deliberate blocking of aid. They warned that their government's policies could be contributing to grave violations of international law, war crimes, and even ethnic cleansing or genocide. The signers also say they have already raised concerns through internal channels but were ignored. The document does not include the names of signers because they fear reprisals. A South African youth has used his iconic neighborhood as the perfect canvas to highlight the plight of the Palestinian people. By adorning the walls of their homes with murals for Gaza, the community located on the slopes overlooking Cape Town hoped the message of Palestine's fight for liberation will be seen. Hassan Syria took a closer look.
Born of political exiles brought to the Cape of Good Hope by Dutch colonialists, the old Malay quarter of Cape Town, better known as Boerkop, is reaching back to its roots as a location of protest by raising a flag for Palestine.
The houses of workup have always been painted in eye-catching colours, but the walls of these homes have now taken on a whole new meaning. Tourists regularly frequent this area, and the paintings here convey a message that will travel around the world.
As Palestinians continue to endure the deadly Israeli onslaught on Gaza, a young South African nurse has taken the initiative by painting what some say is the largest mural of its kind for Palestine. He says by painting this large Palestinian flag in a location overlooking the Cape Town Central Business District, Palestine cannot be ignored.
With tourism comes photography, and I decided to allow the world to protest inadvertently from every angle, from every ad, from every Instagram post. Anybody who comes to Bukup will be for Palestine.
Since launching the Murals for Gaza campaign, Khirdin says scores of residents have asked that their walls be painted to demonstrate support for Palestine. The project has also been taken up in other communities.
I'm just happy that I'm going to get it on my wall, because we have all the people walking down here, and it tells a big story. It tells a tremendous story about the genocide that's what's happening.
If the mainstream media will not report on the atrocities being committed in Gaza, then the walls will speak. That is what we're working with. So we are just making that every wall is going to tell a story from every angle, from the birth of Zionism to the atrocities being committed to the strength and unity of this particular neighborhood on where we stand in the genocide.
Bukup, on the periphery of the Cape Town CBD, has had to contend with its own struggle of gentrification, as big business and foreigners have tried to evict the traditional residents from their ancestral homes. So they understand well the enduring struggle of Palestinians against the colonial settlers. Hassan Siriep, Cape Town.
And with that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for being with us. Take care and bye-bye.
Epic. Glory. Honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
See the world through IRIB English Radio, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
In the limelight. Donald Trump has long claimed he personally owed tens of millions of dollars to an obscure entity related to a Chicago tower. But court documents now claim the Trump Organization now says the loan never existed. And as a result, Trump may have evaded taxes on $48 million in income. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The American newspaper The Daily Beast has covered this story and tells us more. Always read the footnotes. That's where former federal judge Barbara Jones, the court-appointed special monitor in Donald Trump's New York business fraud case, just planted a financial bombshell that legal experts say suggests Donald Trump lied knowingly and repeatedly on his federal financial disclosures about a major loan that never existed and may have evaded taxes on $48 million in income. The detail came in a letter Barbara Jones filed on Friday, 26th of January, to update New York Judge Arthur Engoron, first reported by The Messenger, on her efforts to get a full and clear accounting of the Trump Organization's assets. The letter claims yet again that Donald Trump and his company have filed statements containing inconsistencies and errors, but have been cooperative in the review process. But former Judge Barbara Jones tucked a major revelation into footnote 6, writing that a massive chunk of debt Trump has claimed to owe one of his own companies for years apparently does not exist and never did. When I inquired about this loan, I was informed that there are no loan agreements that memorialize the loan, but that it was a loan that was believed to be between Donald J. Trump individually and Chicago Unit Acquisition for $48 million, Jones wrote, referencing the name of Trump's LLC that held his debt. However, in recent discussions with the Trump Organization, it indicated that it has determined that this loan never existed, and thus that it would be removed from any upcoming form submitted to the Office of Government Ethics, and would also be removed from subsequent versions of corporate financial statements, Barbara Jones wrote. If true, that would essentially be an admission that the Trump Organization, that all the financial disclosures Trump has filed with the federal government listed an entirely fictional debt worth tens of millions of dollars, which Donald Trump claimed he personally owed to one of his own companies. Asked to comment on Barbara Jones's letter, Alan Garten, chief legal counsel for the Trump Organization, told the Daily Beast that her claim that the company confessed to the loan never existing was inaccurate, and the loan did in fact exist. That's one of the many inaccuracies contained in the monitor's letter, which we will be addressing with the court, Alan Garten said in a phone interview. Moreover, in contradiction to the ex-president's own statements about the mystery loan, Alan Garten repeatedly insisted that the LLC actually owed the money to Donald Trump. Asked to confirm the loan, Garten replied, yes, the loan existed, specifying that it was an internal loan where Trump lent money to the entity that he owns. Yet all of Trump's financial disclosures, including his most recent amended version approved by the Office of Government Ethics last October, clearly state that it was Trump who owed Chicago Unit Acquisition LLC. He's consistently listed his debt as more than $50 million in the form of what's known as springing loan, a loan with unfavorable terms to the borrower. In fact, Trump confirmed this arrangement himself. In a 2016 interview with the New York Times, Donald Trump claimed that he bought back his loan from a group of banks several years ago. Trump said that he's chosen to keep the debt on his books, the New York Times reported, claiming that he pays interest on it to himself, despite the LLC's practically worthless valuation. We don't assess any value to it because we don't care, Trump said in the interview. I have the mortgage, that is all there is. Very simple, I am the bank. Jordan Leibowitz, communications director at Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, said that, assuming the court filing is accurate, Donald Trump would appear to have intentionally and repeatedly broken the law. The British newspaper The Independent asks, did Donald Trump evade taxes with a fake loan? Watchdog discovers Chicago deal that never existed. Days before an expected final judgment in a fraud case that could imperil Donald Trump's sprawling business empire, A court-appointed monitor overseeing his businesses reported financial disclosures that are either incomplete, present results inconsistently, or contain errors. One of those findings, according to her report, appears to suggest that the former president evaded taxes on millions of dollars in income by hiding money in fake loan transactions. Donald Trump and his associates have been cooperative throughout the months-long monitoring process, former federal judge Barbara Jones wrote in her 12-page report on Friday, 26th of January. But one detail in a footnote halfway through the letter to New York judge Arthur Engoron appears to allege that the former president not only repeatedly lied about his net worth and assets, as alleged by the state's attorney general, but that a major $48 million loan for one of his brand building properties may have never actually existed. When I inquired about this loan, I was informed that there are no loan agreements that memorialize the loan, Barbara Jones wrote, but that it was a loan that was believed to be between Donald J. Trump individually and Chicago Unit Acquisition, the name of Mr. Trump's LLC that took on the debt for his Trump International Hotel and Tower in the Windy City. However, in recent discussions with the Trump Organization, it indicated that it has determined that this loan never existed, and thus that it would be removed from any upcoming forms submitted to government agencies and in corporate financial statements, Barbara Jones wrote. The report strikes at a mystery that has bounced around for several years. Donald Trump has reported in financial statements that he owes over $50 million to Chicago Unit Acquisition LLC, an entity that Donald Trump owns and thus has owed a substantial sum of money to a company that he controls. Yes, the loan existed, according to Alan Garten, chief legal counsel for the Trump Organization, speaking to the Daily Beast, which first reported the $48 million detail. That's one of many inaccuracies contained in the monitor's letter, which we will be addressing with the court, Garten said. He called the loan arrangements an internal loan, wherein Donald Trump loaned money to the entity that he owns. But Mr. Trump claimed in a financial statement as recently as last October that the arrangement was the opposite, listing debts to Chicago Unit Acquisition as more than $50 million. In 2016, Donald Trump confirmed that arrangement in an interview with the New York Times, claiming that he bought back the loan from a group of banks several years ago and that he pays interest on it to himself, despite the LLC's practically worthless valuation. "We don't assess any value to it because we don't care," Trump said at the time. "I have the mortgage, that is all there is. Very simple, I am the bank." In 2018, Mother Jones reported Donald Trump may have fabricated the loan to make it appear that his LLC owed debt that had already been forgiven, allowing him to evade taxes on $48 million of cancelled debt. The letter from the court-appointed monitor in the fraud case 6 years later could bolster that central claim that the loan never existed.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint.
a critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohammed Jawad, hosting this program, and my guest speakers, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Yasser. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Yasser, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. It was a pleasure to be with you, Madam Muhammad Jawad.
Thank you very much. And Sayyid Abdullah, thank you very much, and welcome to the studio.
Alaikum assalam, bro, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
It was a pleasure.
You're welcome. From the last episode onwards, we started criticizing a movie with a religious theme. Actually, it was about witchcraft. That is called Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Bodrov, produced in 2014. We're going to continue criticizing this movie, but before that, let's take a short listen to a part of this movie, and then we'll be back. Don't go away.
Did you miss me? You have, haven't you? Don't try to deny it. I can see into your soul.
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. With me, Mohammed Jawad, hosting this program, and Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Yasser helping me as my guest speakers in the studio criticize the movie Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Bodrov, produced in 2014. Brother Yasser, there is a conversation between the knight, Master Grigori, and the demon, basically the witch or the queen of the dark, suggested by the movie in different parts, of course, who claims, the demon says, I can see into your soul. Is that correct? Can demons see into the souls of human beings?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Again, understanding the movie is a movie of fantasy. What do we mean by soul in the movie compared to what soul is meant by in Islamic or religious concept is maybe different. For example, soul just made me a person's thoughts. Mm-hmm. I can read your thoughts. Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay, that's not something extreme or something difficult when human beings can do that to other human beings. Someone can have the ability to do that, to kind of just pick up. For example, even us, for example, you can pick up certain vibes. You say, I pick up a certain vibe from somebody. Right? So you know that. It's just something natural that happens. Right?
Right.
You have the ability to do that because of the demeanor of the person, the act of the person, whatever else you see from that person, the face expressions of the person.
Mm-hmm.
So in this sense, first of all, what you mean by soul here, it may not mean like the soul that we mean in the ruh or the spirit or the essence of a human being.
Yes.
Yeah, it just may be a person's thoughts or a feelings and emotions of a person, which obviously love is one of them. Again, what we mean by soul in Islamic theology or in even religious theology is something very difficult to actually discuss and to understand. Throughout history of religion, there have been different opinions of what a soul actually is. Contemporarily or in the current era, most of the Islamic philosophers use the Sadrian model of what the soul is, which obviously this is not the platform to discuss that particular model. But in this particular movie, in this particular thing, I don't think what is meant here is soul as per the essence of a human being. It's more like the thoughts and emotions of a person, which is not something that difficult to do, something that me and you can, we do it all the time as well.
I see.
So, yeah, but in terms of the other ones, seeing into a person's soul, if you really want to know it, a person can only do that if they have what is known as saitara, or a encompassing of that person's soul in their own being.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, like you have encompassed the existence or the essence of that person within you, so to speak.
I see.
So, like one of the examples I would always give is the examples of those Russian dolls. You know, you have a doll within the doll, and then another doll within the doll as well. So is that only then will we be able to truly understand the essence of another person, because it is attached to you. Other than that, no, it's not possible at all to kind of know that soul or the essence of another person.
You know, in terms of different ideologies and different, what do you call it, tradition, whether you're talking about like the world mysticism, there's a distinction made between the soul and the spirit, right? The spirit is that transcendental, immaterial part of human being, whereas the soul is the eminent, immaterial part, which is lower in comparison, like in level, right? Or in terms of different mystical realms and planes. But when you refer to, for example, the Eastern type of mentality or mysticism, for example, they are talking about like the different layers of human beings, like the seven, sometimes up to 12, or even I've seen 22 layers of human beings. Of course, some of them transcend the human beings. Like seven of them, in fact, stay within the human body, like starting from the root, for example, the chakras, and then going up and up to the crown chakra, and even upper than the head of the person. So there are different kinds of distinctions, right? Or different kinds of classifications given in terms of like the soul, the spirit, or if the it, other
or in this, what
layers.
Is, yeah, so what is easier to understand it is that there's one reality, one thing, but has different modes of looking at it. Like, for example, even if you look at it in an Islamic or anything, the soul has different faculties. So there's one thing, one reality, and it has different things that it does. It's one thing. It is not something different. It's not you have three, four different souls or three, four different spirits. It's one thing that has different faculties, or a particular aspect of that soul is doing something. So even when it comes to Hinduism or when it comes to Buddhism, it's the same concept. One reality. But the reality in connection of what is being seen is different. Like, for example, you have this thing like in Buddhism, this you have, even they say to achieve nirvana, you have to ensure that your soul becomes one with the higher reality.
Yeah, they achieve union.
But that union is what is that your soul and all its aspects come to an equilibrium. But it's one reality. But all the aspects of one reality comes to, for example, even Islamic ethics, we have that. You have the three faculties of lust, of what's the other one? Anger, and of the intellect. You have those three.
Yes.
So a person reaches equilibrium when he's able to take these three faculties, which are all part of one reality, and put them in equilibrium, and reach what is known as become, I don't know, or
Aristotelian temperance.
Temperance. So he reaches i'tidal, or this equilibrium.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's one reality. And even, for example, in Islamic mysticism, in essence, the spirit of the soul, is one reality. It's just two aspects of how you're looking at that one reality. Are you looking at that one reality as a, you know, as a metaphysical reality? Or are you looking at it as a physical reality? But it's, at the end of the day, it is one reality that has two aspects to it.
I see. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break by listening to a part of the movie Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Bodrov, produced in 2014. And then we'll be back with his criticism. Don't go away.
I'm sorry, Master. Permission is vago!
Para Isenix!
No! Master Gregory!
Permission!
Don't expect sympathy from him. His heart is blacker than mine. You're with me now.
Let him go!
I can feel the dark.
Oh,
I can't stand it!
Let him go! I will burn you!
Master Gregory!
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Brother Yasser and Syed Abdullah helping me as my guest speakers criticize the movie Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Bodrov, produced in 2014. Syed Abdullah, in this part of the movie, the demon or the evil witch captures the boy, the knight's assistant or apprentice, the old one, of course, in a metal cage. The knight sets fire to her, to the demon or the witch, but she doesn't burn. Is that because the jinns, this is what I'm reminded of, because the jinns are made of fire, kind of fire, of course.
Yeah.
So they cannot be burned with fire?
Well, I mean, technically speaking, yes. You can't burn fire with fire. So jinn in their essence, but I mean that's if we're being very literal, because even though jinn are made from fire, it's like if they present themselves today, you're not going to see like a flame. Uh-huh. You're going to see like a different, like we, the Quran says we made it from clay. But there's no, not even a trace of clay in our body.
Yeah.
Like technically speaking, because we're flesh and bone and blood.
Yeah.
So our initial creation was like that. So jinn now, would they be able to, can you burn them in fire? Perhaps, because like I said, even though their true essence was, you can kill me with the clay, right?
Yes.
Because even though I made it from clay, but you can still kill me with the clay. Yeah. So with jinn, would you be able, I don't know, no one has killed a jinn to tell us how they killed him or they burnt him. However, the Quran mentions something very important. When the samawat was locked and yes. the jinn cannot access the realm and they cannot see the malaika, the Quran says any jinn that tries to cross, we will send a shuhab, right? Mm. Like a comet, which is like a burning comet that kills them. So maybe at the end of the day.
Yeah, in the astral realm.
Yeah.
Of course. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break by listening to a part of the movie Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Bodrov, produced in 2014, and then we'll be back with this criticism. Don't go away.
The ward residents!
Who's asking?
I understand there's a seventh son of a seventh son that lives here. Do not say there's not, for I know that there is. I'm in a hurry.
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Mohammed Jawad, hosting this program, and my guest speaker, Syed Abdullah and Brother Yasser, helping me criticize the movie Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Bodrov, produced in 2014. Brother Yasser, in that part of the movie, the knight, Master Gregory, seeks to find a seventh son. This is where the movie actually gets its title from. After losing his apprentice, the last apprentice, that was killed by the demon or the witch, what's so special about the seventh son? Is it for real? Does the order of the birth affect magic or exorcism?
I think, again, because what we're dealing with here is a fantasy movie. But when you, if you want to look at it in a very general kind of way, symbolism and numerology, yes, has a part to play yes. in the world we have. I mean, even in many teachings, religious or even non-religious teachings, you have yes. Numbers being involved.
Mm-hmm.
For example, why do you circumambulate the Kaaba 7 times? Why do you, for example, read 4 rakats in a particular salah?
Mm-hmm.
Why not 10? Why not 12? And so on and so forth. Why you read a particular surah this amount of times? 7. Mm-hmm. We have number 7 is very prominent in Islamic teachings. Yes. Very prominent.
Yes.
7, 14, 40, 12, 14. These are just numbers. Don't know what they mean, but these are numbers that are very prominent. As
stated in the archetypes, even propounded or suggested by Carl Gustav Jung, you know, that he found certain qualities to be like in the DNA of human being. Even if you search the whole humanity and the history of mankind, you still find the same themes recurring.
Yeah, but in this instance, for example, what we are trying to understand is that does that particular number symbolize a particular reality that's beyond it?
Yes.
And one of the things that we have to understand is that in ancient Greek, the concept of the Pythagoras and Pythagorean philosophers based their entire philosophy on numbers. That a particular number represents something outside.
Yes.
Like 9 was a very powerful number. Why? It was the end. After that becomes what? You start joining up numbers. 1 and 0, 1 and 2, 1 and 3. So yes. 9 was a number of infinity. Mm-hmm. Like in Islam, 7, just because we think about 7, 7 is a number of abundance, of a lot.
I see.
So what's one of the things about 7? Why do things 7 times? So again, yes, numbers are important. Unfortunately, it requires a lot of research into what it actually represents because they are just symbols.
And we also had sciences.
We have a science.
Like
Jafar, Ilma Jafar, new numerology. Well, yeah. Yes, numerology, it is definitely there.
Yeah.
It is definitely, but what it is, you need somebody who's an expert in it to truly understand it.
Thank you very much, Brother Yasser. And thank you very much, Syed Abdullah, for your nice comments and answers to the questions and criticism of the movie Seventh Son, directed by Sergei Bodrov, produced in 2014. Thank you very much, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, محمد جواد سانینا و السلام علیکم و رحمت الله و برکاته.
If you see a witch, kill it.
We're not all evil, you know.
I can't do this. I'm not like you.
Join us.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
As the Zionist occupation continues its horrific massacres and, yes, ongoing genocide, more countries will feel inclined to move away from the Zionist regime, especially as legal proceedings advance. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV noted, recently the long-awaited ruling of the International Court of Justice, ICJ, on the unfolding genocide in Gaza was delivered. It drew mixed responses, with some hailing it as a historic ruling and some others expressing their anger and disappointment. For anyone familiar with international law, especially under a U.S.-based global hegemonic order, tempering expectations is a must for such trials. We must take from this trial what we can and soberly analyze the shortcomings of the international system where necessary. The Hague-based court, led by a panel of 17 judges and representatives, began hearing by dismissing Israel's request to throw out the case entirely, which is an objective win for the Palestine case. For too long, the apartheid regime has enjoyed the cushion of the so-called American rules-based order, which only works for U.S. clients and against anyone else. It cannot be overstated that this specific detail, though small at face value, is itself a crushing defeat for the Zionist regime, which will now officially in international law and history have its name tethered toward genocide. The top UN court issued provisional measures for the Zionist regime to be taken immediately. By 15 votes to 2, Israel shall, in accordance with its obligations under the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide in relation to the Palestinians in Gaza, take all measures within its power to prevent the commission of all acts within the scope of the Article 2 of the Convention, in particular, A. killing members of the group, B. causing serious bodily or mental harm to the members of the group, C. deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, and D. imposing measures intended to prevent birth within the group. By 15 votes to 2, Israel shall ensure with immediate effect that its military does not commit any acts described in point 1 above. By 16 votes to 1, Israel shall take all measures within its power to prevent and punish the direct and public incitement to commit genocide in relation to members of the Palestinian group in the Gaza Strip. By 16 votes to 1, Israel shall take immediate and effective measures to ensure the provision of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance to address the adverse conditions of life faced by Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. By 15 votes to 2, Israel shall take effective measures to prevent the destruction and ensure the preservation of evidence related to allegations of acts within the scope of Article 2 and Article 3 of the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide against members of the Palestinian group in the Gaza Strip. By 15 votes to 2, Israel shall submit a report to the court on all measures taken to give effect to this order within 1 month, as from the date of the order. Much to the chagrin of many, both in Palestine and elsewhere, the provisional measures did not call for a ceasefire. The Zionist regime's aggression on the population of Gaza during the time of this issue has led to the murder of over 26,000 Palestinians, nearly half of them children, and thousands more trapped under the rubble still unaccounted for. The ICJ has acknowledged that genocidal crimes may be happening, but denying the Palestinians a ceasefire or not placing any independent mechanism to enforce the cessation of these hostilities has created a situation that tells on itself how limited its power is, at least for the Palestinian cause. The provisional measures also ask for the Tel Aviv occupation to report on itself and for it to hold itself accountable. Per the first ruling, Israel shall take all measures within its power to prevent the commission of all acts within the scope of Article 2 of the Convention. The Zionist regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, leading up to the court decision, commented on the aggression on Gaza, saying, "No one will stop us, not the Hague, not the axis of evil, and no one else. It is possible and necessary to continue until victory, and we will do it." Clearly, the child killer regime of Israel cannot be trusted to uphold the provisional measures from the very get-go. The Zionist regime has rejected and mocked the court and the UN as a whole, using its usual go-to smear of painting any of its opponents as anti-Semites. Despite these shortcomings, we must give credit where it is due. Not to the courts, but to the South African legal team who prepared an airtight case against the Zionist regime using the Zionist regime's own genocidal words and actions. With any crime of this caliber, the harder thing to do is to prove the intent of the crime. South Africa's legal team used Israeli officials' own statements and clips posted by Zionist troops in Gaza to force the court to proceed forward with the case, where the Tel Aviv regime's strategy was to throw the case out entirely. The case was built with precision. All but one judge supported the provisional measures, Julia Sebutain from Uganda. The government of Uganda immediately moved to distance itself from her. Indeed, the court decision has shown the world the limitations of the so-called rules-based order and of international appendages, but it also highlights the growing international isolation of the Zionist regime when held to account by an airtight case. The United States, Canada, the UK, and the EU have all stood in complete defense of the Zionist occupation throughout this entire legal dispute, with the United States calling South Africa's case meritless. The court moving forward with South Africa's use of the Genocide Convention pushes these countries, on the record, to one side of history while holding the Palestinian cause on another. Many countries have lined up behind South Africa and therefore Palestine, knowing full well that the time to take sides on the international stage is now. It is also worth noting that on the same day, this decision was delivered. The US, UK, Australia and Canada, all countries who have given unfettered support to the Zionist regime, cut off all funding from the UN appendage UNRWA, which provides vital support to Palestinians suffering in Gaza. The countries cite unverified Zionist claims that UNRWA employees were part of the October 7th military operation against Israeli occupation bases. However, given the timing of the UN decision and the Zionist smear campaign against the world body as a whole, it is clear this is politically motivated in order to punish the UN and send a message. As the Israeli occupation continues its horrific massacres and, yes, ongoing genocide against Gaza, more countries will feel inclined to move away from the Zionist regime, especially as legal proceedings advance. Think of it as holding your hand to a fire. Most sensible people know not to do this, but only the most arrogant people will insist on doing so, despite the severe burns it may cause. South Africa also intends to take the US and the UK to court for its complicity in the Gaza genocide. Clear lines are being drawn using the US own rules and order against it. For Palestinians and freedom fighters across the world, this legal scenario does indeed highlight the trajectory of growing extinction of so-called Western rules-based order, but all the while demonstrating the ineffectiveness of its own established organs. Where these organs are quick to act for US interest, they offer less than enthusiastic risk slaps when clear genocide is being conducted by a regime that does not care for rules. Indeed, there is no substitute for underground resistance. As the Zionist aggression continues, you can count on the axis of resistance to continue to deliver the necessary blows to the Israeli occupation in the court of Palestinian justice.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.